Hi, everybody. My name is Paul Buiting, and it's a great honor to have on the show today my old friend Alistair MacLeod from the UK. Hi, Alistair.
Hello, Paul. It's very nice to speak to you again.
Yeah, how have you been?
Well, been fine. We're in lockdown. Gold is running. What's not to like? Except the economy's absolute trash. But, you know, that small detail we can live with.
Yeah, at least the upside is then that gold is going up, and that's something you've been talking about for all these years, of course. Maybe to start off, you are on record to have said that you don't like big government and you ideally don't want government expenses to be more than 20% of GDP. Given that you're an Austrian and that you don't like much government intervention, how would you, if you were given the role of running the country, how would you have dealt with it then? Because a lot of money printing is going on, you're against that. A lot of people are being kept at work, employers are being compensated with subsidies and all of that. Would you have just not done all of that? Would you have let the economy crash, basically?
Well, I think we must draw a distinction between economic theory and political reality. The two things are actually very, very different. I mean, there is absolutely no way this country, which is completely Keynesian, would accept Austrian economic theory as the driving force for the economy. I think there might come a time when it happens, but the only time when that will happen is when we have a real crisis and everybody stares into the downside and doesn't like what they see. At that point, a statesman-like leader who understands economics could then steer this country, your country, any country, out of this sort of, if you like, the drive towards increasing inflation, which is really financing welfare. Government responsibilities are increasing the whole time. That has got to be reversed. And there's got to be an understanding that the role of government is just to do very, very simple things. Ensure that there are practical laws in place to govern how we relate to each other, and particularly in the form of contracts. And those have got to be as clear as possible, and also to defend the country in the case of attack. But other than that, there really is no sensible economic role for the government. So that's what I refer to when I say that, you know, if we were going to get the stability that we need in the future, then there are conditions that have to go into place. The stability can only come through monetary stability. But the other side of that is you can't have monetary stability, let's say an operating gold standard of some sort, with the government being 40, 45% of GDP. I mean, it just does not work, because government cannot cover those liabilities when it cannot print money. So, yeah. You know,
there's a long-term vision you have, but in order to get there, society first need to go through rehab or something, and you need to slowly
reduce the government. That's a good way of putting it. But of course, whether that'll happen immediately or simply out of this crisis is another question. I mean, history has shown, I mean, if you look at Germany, for example, after her great inflation in the early 1920s, that led to Hitler. And that led into Second World War. So the idea that we can just demolish the current situation, do away with the welfare state, do away with government responsibility for all our actions, and then expect, you know, the sort of the economy to just progress and we will have live happily ever after. Well, it's a big ask, and it really does need, I think, the right sort of leadership to steer us away from the extremes that are likely to come out of big political changes.
Yeah, I see. You want to avoid some vacuum to arise where the wrong people take control, just like happened in Germany.
Yeah.
And last week I spoke to Steve Keen, and he's more of a big government kind of guy, and he says that looking at the way the governments in Asia have managed the crisis or the pandemic is actually an argument in favor of more government instead of less government, because the more liberal countries in the West have been dealing with the crisis in a less efficient, less effective way. Of course, you can argue against that. So this could also be a victory for more state-controlled economies. What would you say?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would disagree with Steve's conclusion that big government is the only answer. I would disagree very strongly with that, because if that was the case, then let's just go back to the USSR and let's go back to Mao. I mean, I'm sorry, but it just does not work. There is no doubt that we are losing freedoms. Liberal is the wrong word, really, because liberal basically is liberalism. But if you like this sort of mixed economy thing, which is essentially socialist with a bit of capitalism on the side, it's a continual drift away from free markets into controlled markets, regulated markets, and so on. And the more that happens, the more as a society, we tend to look to government to provide. And so when you get a problem like this virus, we immediately expect the government to deal with it. Not us, we expect the government to deal with it. But getting back to a sort of question you half asked, what one would one do now? I think having had the shock, a sensible government would take the view that having educated everybody, made them aware that this is something that is very dangerous, they must continually wash their hands, they must social distance, they must be careful about where they go and what they do, then leave it to people, because people aren't stupid.
In a society with small government and highly educated or well-educated people, you don't need a lockdown enforced by the government, because people would automatically assume that's the right thing to do and would behave accordingly.
Yeah, and there's some evidence that this is actually the case in places like Sweden, which has been very successful without a lockdown. I mean, so it sort of raises the question, is a lockdown really necessary? I mean, we don't actually know the answer to that, because all the statistics coming out of different countries are themselves, sort of collected differently. So we just don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. But I think that Sweden did indicate that if you allow people to make up their own minds to look after how to look after themselves, give them the information about the dangers, and then leave it to them, I think there's a lot to be said for it.
Yeah, you put great faith in humanity. I like it, because I'm also an optimistic guy. Let's move to monetary matters. Of course, that's your specialty. You've been saying a few times now that you expect hyperinflation to happen as a result of all this monetary expansion. At the same time, after previous crisis, we also had a lot of monetary expansion, and also a lot of gold bulls were saying we're going to have hyperinflation soon, but it didn't happen. Of course, there was inflation in asset prices, but not the complete loss of confidence in the currency. Why do you think this time is different?
Well, I take slight issue with what you're saying, because we have had inflation ever since 1971, when the Nixon shock ended the Bretton Woods system, which was temporary, by the way. Just in case anyone viewing this sort of thinks that was the end of a period. That was apparently temporary. Anyway, I think we can take it as being permanent. Yeah. But since then, the dollar has lost roughly 97.5% of its purchasing power. Sterling has lost 98.5% of its purchasing power. The yen has lost about 92% of its purchasing power. And the euro, and if you take the constituents of the euro as calculated, you're looking again at a sort of 98% loss, something like that. So monetary inflation has had a really substantial effect on the purchasing power of these currencies. I'm measuring them compared with the purchasing power of gold. Now, the purchasing power of gold does tend to rise over time, but it's a gentle rise. So it probably overstates the situation by 1% or 2%, but no more than that. So we've had that sort of long period, if you like, of a drip feed of loss of purchasing power for paper currencies. If you look at the history of collapse of paper currencies, you very often get that sort of long run in. And then suddenly there comes a point where the public wakes up to what's happening to the money. They realize that it's not the prices of the everyday goods rising, that they buy rising. They begin to think, hold on a minute, something happening to our money. And there's something fascinating in cryptocurrencies in this respect, because if you look at what's happened with, particularly with Bitcoin, people have now been educated that through the relative pace of the issuance of a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, which is very, very limited, compared with what governments do with fiat currencies, they're waking up earlier than we might otherwise have thought in history. You know, as intelligent members of the public, you know, intelligent Chinese, intelligent people in California, people like you, dare I say, you know, you suddenly realize that, hold on a minute, it's money going down, not prices going up. So what do I do? Get rid of the money. And when the general public latch on to that, there is no hope for the currency. And that is what I foresee, triggered by two things. Firstly, the coronavirus, which is the obvious thing. But even before the coronavirus came in, there was a developing collapse in bank credit. The amount of liquidity within the monetary system. I mean, we saw back in September, mid-September, the repo market in New York failed. Now, when we say failed, basically what we mean is that the contraction of available bank credit was such that there was suddenly a crisis and the rate jumped from the sort of 1.5-2% level up to 10%. So the Fed then had to step in, because obviously if it didn't step in, it was going to lose control over interest rates. We have already a crisis without the coronavirus problem, because if banks are restricting their expansion of credit and looking to reduce their balance sheets, which is now very much the case, and you also look at what's been happening on the international trade front, because for a good 18 months before that September crisis in the repo market, international trade was collapsing. And it was collapsing basically because of the tariff war between America and China. There is precedent for this, the combination of end of credit cycle and tariffs, and that was 1929, October 1929, when the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was passed by Congress on the 30th of October that year. That month, when the market got, if you like, began to sort of get nervous about these things, that month, the Dow Jones fell 30% top to bottom. There was then a period of consolidation while there were attempts by Hoover to try and rescue the system. You know, they tried to inject more money into the system. They were doing what the Fed is doing now, but on a relatively minor scale. And by the middle of 1930, it was beginning to fail. Hoover signed Smoot-Hawley into law, I think it was in about May or June 1930. And then Wall Street just slid down and down and down. And by the time it had finished, it lost 90% of its value from the top. Yeah. We have exactly the same situation without the coronavirus. Take that situation, put the coronavirus on top, you can see the damage that is being done. And we're only just beginning to see the start of it.
But it is quite similar to the narrative that, because I was working for gold money back in the day as well, and I've been in this alternative money sphere for God knows how long. But after the previous expansion, a lot of people were also exactly drawing historical parallels and saying, look, this has to end in hyperinflation. But at least what the central banks did, they gave the system another 10, 12 years to breathe. Not saying it's the right thing to do, but they were able to extend and pretend. Why would they not be able to do that again?
Purely because of the scale of it. I mean, I remember that time, and I remember you and I were talking about it. I reckoned that in the wake of the Lehman crisis, the Fed effectively wrote checks totaling about $13 trillion. And you know, because they took in the whole of the mortgage system and so on. That was unprecedented. And I think being a purely financial crash, which is what it was a financial crash, we all heaved a sigh of relief and said, thank goodness they've saved the banking system. This is different. This is an industrial problem. And by definition, we're then talking jobs. You know, we're talking about increased costs on government from welfare. We're talking about throwing money at the underlying economy. Now, if you throw money at the underlying economy, then you debase the currency as it is used in the underlying economy. And that is one of the two essential differences between the aftermath of the Lehman crisis and the likely aftermath of this one. The other one is that the Fed is taking on a far larger problem this time. One of the things that's notable about the whole system shutting down is supply chains have been disrupted. Now, the other side of supply chains are payments. You know, if I don't deliver the part manufactured good that you turn into something bigger, you're not going to pay me. Meanwhile, I've got wages, I've got establishment costs, I've got, you know, all the costs of manufacturing, but I can't get it to you, either because of the transportation problems, or I can't complete making my bit because one of my suppliers is not supplying me. He's on, you know, he's shut his factory, or he's been told to shut his factory, or whatever. So really, if you look at the extent of this, it's not GDP, it's far larger than GDP. You have to look at a statistic called gross output. Gross output tracks all the payment flows in the different stages of the manufacture of a product. Gross output in America is in the order of $38 trillion.
Now, I'm not saying double GDP or something, is that?
It's more or less double, yeah, not quite double. But and it probably doesn't capture it all, actually, because it's the nature of a statistic like that. What we're looking at is probably not supporting $38 trillion worth of supply chain payments, but it's a very big figure. It could easily be $20 trillion. And then there's the overseas side, because that is only the payments chain. Gross output is the payments chain within America, but you've got goods which are imported into America. You know, machinery, bits of machinery, bits of your iPhone, whatever it might be. I mean, it is so vast. And to an extent, the Fed has dealt with that by increasing swap lines to a number of banks. I mean, originally there were six banks, they were the major banks, and now they've added about another, I think, seven, eight, nine banks, which are sort of, if you like, second tier central banks, where they have now got these swap lines going, notably not with China. Yeah. So I wonder, you know, there is a political element in this which is rather unwelcome, but anyway.
Yeah. But supply chains are also starting again, right? For example, now that there was no hand sanitizer and masks available a few weeks ago, and now I see everyone trying to offer them, even with a discount, probably because they've too much in stock. So supply chains are slowly but surely being restarted again. Of course, you have the old invoices to deal with and the old costs, but that's then, I guess, where the Fed and the central banks and governments try to provide a backstop. So it can be...
Yeah. But I mean, do not underestimate the size of this. Now, on top of that, they have another thing, and that is they've got to fund the government deficit, which is just going bananas. Yeah. I mean, the total receipts, US government receipts are less than $4 trillion, $3.7 trillion or something. That is going to collapse, obviously, because taxes. And at the same time, the government is... through the Treasury has been sending out checks to every family. The estimates for the government deficit are now rocketing to considerably more than their total receipts. I mean, you know, so instead of it being a balancing figure, you know, you've got sort of income and expenses, and the expenses are less than the income, or the expenses are slightly more than the income, like $1 trillion or something. We're now looking at the expenses are, you know, they just dwarf the income. The income's sort of, you know, basically being wiped out, but the expenses that the government are incurring are absolutely enormous, greater than their, you know, the previous, if you like, total figures.
Yeah.
So you've got that. And importantly, the other thing is that the approach of the Fed is to try and preserve the, you know, sort of personal wealth, if you like, the wealth effect, try and keep the show on the road. If people feel wealthy and happy, then everything will be all right, is the sort of mantra. This has been the case, actually, ever since Greenspan. But now they have got to support the whole of the domestic and international financial markets. and make sure that they don't go down. Why? Because the one thing they can't afford to see is the cost of funding for the US government to rise. Now, the last time we actually had this situation where the whole thing worked on basically keeping the financial markets highly valued was John Law 300 years ago in France. He had only two things to keep puffed up. One was his Banque Royale, which was his money machine, like the Fed, if you like.
Yeah. And the financial markets.
And the other one was the Mississippi Venture. And around about December 1719, the scheme of puffing up the Mississippi Venture shares by issuing livre, unbacked currency, was beginning to sort of run into difficulties. The Banque Royale and the Mississippi Venture were meant to be merged on the 28th of February, 1720. One thing that actually didn't help was that King Louis decided that he wanted to take some of the profits out of the system. So he took something like about a billion livres of stuff out. So that didn't actually have to help. That didn't help because John Law had to run and find someone to buy it. Anyway, it was absorbed. Guess how? Printing money. And this sounds familiar, perhaps.
So, anyway, so maybe it's time for the John Law Award this year, then, well, the central banker that inflates his balance sheet the most.
Yeah, absolutely. But what happened was that by the September of 1720, there was notionally a value for the Mississippi Venture. It had fallen from 12,000 livres down to about 1,000 livres. But guess what? The value of the livre was zero. It just completely destroyed itself. Yeah. And so going back to what I was saying about there comes a time when people begin to realize what's happening to their money, this seems to me the effort to try and keep financial markets overvalued, if it fails, and it will fail in a similar fashion to John Law's experiment, then I would think by the end of this year, there's a strong possibility that fiat currency won't exist anymore.
And do you believe then that indeed, like you said, the American people wake up and they pull the plug, or foreign creditors pull the plug because they don't trust the dollar anymore?
That's a very good question, because you've highlighted the two ways in which this happens. The first thing that will happen is foreign creditors. Foreign creditors, I mean, you know, we see a lot written about how in a crisis people need dollars. No, that's not true. They need dollar liquidity. And the point behind this is that foreign creditors already own something like $25 trillion worth of securities, short-term instruments, and also bank deposits. So they've already got the dollars. It's just a question of liquidity. So they will sell down their US treasuries. Of that I have no doubt. They will reduce their portfolios in dollars. Why? Because they need the money back at home. I mean, if you've got a problem, you know, if you're, let's say, a British company and you've got a whole load of dollars over there and you've got trouble back here, what do? You sell your dollars because you've got to pay your bills in pounds. So I can see that the first thing will be a run against the dollar will develop. And the effect on domestic prices is likely to hit particularly hard through food. We've already got supply disruptions in the essentials, if you like. I mean, you referred earlier to things like hand sanitizer and so on and so forth. Yeah. Hamburger is probably more important to the Americans, but you can see that food prices are already rising because of disruption in the supply chains as much as anything. And the other thing about it is that once the dollar starts going, then the international price for basic foodstuffs will go up in dollar terms. And that will then put an extra twist on it. Now, if I can just go back to John Law, the real problem that really surfaced in France at that time, which made it politically very difficult for him to continue with this scheme, was that as people were taking money out of his financial system, they were spending it in the real economy and driving up prices, which meant that the poor, who basically lived on at a subsistence level, I mean, everybody lived at a subsistence level until the Industrial Revolution, they starved. And when you get that, you then get the revolution, you get all those social strains which threaten to overturn the status quo completely.
And that's, isn't that also called the Cantillon effect, where the people that get the money first, they are able to profit from it. And then in the end, when it comes to people, for example, like you just described, the poor people, they only get the new money when already the prices are going up. And that will be then waking up moment for ordinary people. That's the currency is being debased.
Yeah, exactly that. Yes. I mean, it's always the rich get it first, and it then sort of trickles down. And by the time the poor get it, they're not earning any more. All they see is food prices go up. And think about pensioners living on fixed pensions. They suffer as well. So you've got a very explosive mixture building. Once that happens, and then the second stage, once it's gone down in the foreign exchanges, the second stage is the people begin to wake up to what's happening to their money or their government's money, and they then begin to realize that it's the money going down, not prices going up. What they should do is just get rid of the money as quickly as possible. I mean, in Germany in the 1920s, that period took roughly six or seven months, from about May to November, when the mark became completely worthless. John Law's time, about 6 months on it. I mean, we have form, if you like, that suggests that once this process starts, there is not very much time left for the currency involved.
But it could also be that...
No, there is a way out. There is a way out of it, Paul. Yeah, there is a way out of it. And that is introduce gold backing, proper, believable gold backing for the currency, so that the currency acts as a gold substitute. But in order to do that, you need to fundamentally change the role of government within society. Society has to look after itself. You have to go back to free markets. And government must cut itself back all the way to, my guess is less than 20%. And if you can get it well under 20%, so much the better. Any more than that, and nothing is sustainable.
Yeah, but if we arrive at free markets, and of course the people can choose their own monies, there is also a chance that especially the younger generation would prefer Bitcoin over gold. So it will then be a battle between different currencies, and it's not certain that gold will win that fight.
It is certain. Because look at it this way. If paper currencies go, what are you going to price your Bitcoin in? You've got to price it in gold.
Then you can also say you have to price gold in Bitcoin, the same argument.
No, it won't be the other way around, because if you look at the volatility for Bitcoin is far greater than the price of gold. Gold will be the stable currency. Bitcoin then, unfortunately, in those circumstances, it loses its reason for existing. So Bitcoin's life, I believe, is tied, if you just sort of think through the theoretical aspects of it, Bitcoin's life is tied to the life of paper currencies. Once they go, the whole rationale for a Bitcoin or something like that goes. I mean, apart from anything else, you're going to need speculative demand to drive it. And in the circumstances we're talking about, speculators are broadly wiped out.
Yeah, but the gold price will also be very volatile. As soon as paper currencies go, then of course gold will appreciate. But that's a scenario. There will be, of course, everyone always says it took the same amount of gold to buy a suit in Roman times as it is to buy a suit right now. But if gold becomes the dominant money worldwide again, prices measured in gold, you have to spend less gold to buy that same suit if gold becomes the dominant money. Isn't that true?
Well, if you're looking at that sort of collapse situation, there is no doubt that the purchasing power of gold will rise in its own right quite significantly. What you can't untie is the element which comes from the collapse in consumer demand or demand for consumer goods from the actual increase in the purchasing power of gold in its own right. There are two elements to this, if you like. But gold is a far more stable entity than Bitcoin ever is. I mean, I ran a chart of Bitcoin priced in gold. And it's just, I mean, okay, Bitcoin goes up, lovely, but it is incredibly volatile. Now, I know you are a great follower of Bitcoin, but you must admit, by far the more volatile of the two is Bitcoin. It is not suitable for transactional money.
I follow both Bitcoin and gold. I follow everything, as you know. And
absolutely.
And of course, there are things to say about volatility, but there are so many different aspects of good money. Yeah? For example, Bitcoin is much more difficult to confiscate. And yesterday I saw an interesting show on Netflix called The Outer Banks, where a bunch of young kids found a lost treasure of gold of 400 million. And they tried to sell that for cash, and they started with one bar, and it was just such a difficult and such a pain in the ass to get rid of the gold. And of course, Bitcoin is much easier to sell with all these exchanges worldwide. So there's so many different aspects to money. But for me, I'm very open-minded, and I look forward to seeing different alternatives competing against each other in order for the market to choose the right money.
Yeah.
That's my.
I hear what you're saying, Paul, but I think what people do not do is they don't imagine the world after fiat currency is gone. It's going to be a completely different environment. And then you have to, I mean, you know, model is the wrong word. I don't like modeling anything. But if you have to think through the roles and the relationships of everything without fiat currency, think it through properly, and then you'll come up with some maybe surprising answers.
Who else there? Great. And one more question I had, like what I see now, that there's a lot of inequality in the world that is also partly the result of government policies such as QE and bailouts and all of that. How do you want to address that? Or is there a way to reverse that? Because I understand why people call, for example, for people's QE, to instead of saving the corporates and the banks this time, to save the citizens. And of course, maybe that's not a sustainable trajectory, because it could lead to hyperinflation and complete collapse of the currency. But I understand the sentiment behind injecting money, base money, in the wallets of households and consumers, also in order to offset some of the awful things that have been done to them over the past 10 years or so or longer. What is your point of view there?
Well, the injustices against people. Okay, if you have free markets, then the king is the consumer. If you don't respond to what the consumer demand is going to be, if you don't anticipate correctly what tomorrow's consumer's demand is going to be, you're out of business. The consumer is king. That's free markets.
Yeah, but as a future state.
We don't have free markets. We have, well, it's been a past state too. I mean, if you look at Britain, the success of Britain really was from about the 1840s onwards. Once they got rid of price controls over wheat, the abolition of the Corn Laws, which then went into complete abolition of all tariffs. Britain then became, from that, the most wealthy nation on earth, with dominions, colonies, such as had never been seen before. And that was really destroyed when we went off sound money and we moved towards larger government. I mean, it was the socialist movements, which really sort of sprung up around about the time of the First World War. So we have had this before. We can see it's not just theory. We can see how it works in practice. But ever since Keynes came in and overturned Say's law, which he did actually by sleight of hand rather than proving that Say's law was a non sequitur, he created a role for government. So we now have economies which are increasingly driven by government. And that introduces in the relationships between business and the consumer this third party called government. So if you're a big business, you go and lobby government to get what you want rather than the consumer being king anymore. It's far easier for a big company to do that. So you get crony capitalism. That is the situation we have. We don't have a proper capitalistic economy anymore. It is basically governments cajoling, so being cajoled by big business to do what big business wants. And so the consumer gets left out in the cold.
Yeah.
The increased financialization of our economies, particularly since the 1980s when you had Big Bang and the end of the Glass-Steagall Act, basically means that banks, instead of lending money to businesses, started using the expansion of bank credit for their own books. They were running their own books. And so you had the complete financialization of particularly the American and the UK economy. The effect of that basically is that you see bankers making a hell of a lot of money for apparently doing nothing. And that does not go down well with a consumer who's not being served that well by his government or by the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
But who does he listen to? He listens to the politicians because there's nobody else talking to him. So you can see how the whole system has become corrupted.
Exactly. But how to how to compensate citizens then for the errors of the past and of all the damages that they've incurred? Because if we go to a new system, for example, sound money system, then all the companies and people that have been receiving the money or have been profiting from the system have a very good starting position also in the new system, unless you start with or you come up with some sort of compensation to compensate for all the errors in the past.
Well, why while I fully understand the non-inflationary environment and what is required, I don't see us getting there without an awful lot of pain. And the pain is likely to come in crisis first, solution second. It may not even be as easy as that. It could be crisis first, another crisis, another crisis, another crisis, then solution. But just bear in mind that before the 1930s, in the previous slump, which was 1920-21, it was a very deep slump. But very, very quickly, we got out of it. And we got out of it basically because government took the view, stand back, you know, let people sort it out. Then along comes President Hoover, followed by FDR with his New Deal, and really from about late 1929 all the way through to the start of World War II, the American economy and also the rest of the world was basically in a prolonged slump. Why? Because government was interfering with everything. If we look to government to resolve our problems, then we sit back and we wait for the solution to come from government. If we understand that government isn't going to resolve our problems, then we get on with it. And that is the difference, if you like. And I think the point about the complete wipeout of paper currency, fiat currency, is that government then has no alternative. It actually has to get out of the way because it cannot fund itself. It might try to struggle on and make lives, all our lives, unpleasant as a result. But without a currency, can't really go for very long. I mean, you end up with absolute anarchy. I mean, you know, you find that the police aren't getting paid, so how are they going to make a living? Basically, they make a living by bribery and extortion and all the rest of it. I mean, I've seen that in Africa. We left, as a country, we left some very good police forces in Africa. They turned into a very oppressive, nasty government force against the people. Anyway.
Yeah, well, that's a scenario we hopefully are going to avoid. Thanks so much, Alistair, for your insights. It was great to have a conversation with you in an open and honest way. Any things you want to close the conversation with?
Well, the only way I think you can protect yourself against this increasingly inevitable outcome is to ensure that you've got some money which will see you firstly through it and then afterwards. Now, seeing it through it, obviously gold, silver, and if you're a fan of cryptocurrencies, get a proper one which has a distributed ledger which government can't get hold of, such as Bitcoin. For afterwards, then you've got to have gold or silver because that will come back as a stabilizing factor.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, Alistair. Stay safe and talk to you again in the future.